From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 27th day of August, 2010. Happy 22nd anniversary to my lovely wife. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics in Lafayette, Indiana. And later in the half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Bruce Bostert. He's the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. In agricultural news, a House of Representatives panel has invited the owners of two Iowa-based egg production companies to come to Washington. U.S. regulators have identified chicken feed as the possible cause for the salmonella outbreak related to those two egg farms. And let's stay with Iowa. Well, along with the rest of the northern Corn Belt states, the Federal Reserve of Chicago says the cost of farmland in the region is up 6%. For the second quarter of 2010. Dave Dickey will have all the details shortly. And later in the program, I'll tell you about some changes that will affect the crops grown on that farmland. RMA has updated its crop insurance product list. There are some things missing, combined, and renamed. We'll hear all about it during this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of the University of Illinois and Illinois Public Media.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
On this Friday afternoon, futures in Chicago and Kansas City finished like this. The hard red from Kansas City for the winter wheat at $7.14, up 9. September soft red at 662.5, up 6. December at 695, up 6.5. And July futures for next year's crop at $7.05, up 7.75. September corn futures 4.5 higher, $4.21 the last trade. December at 436, up 4. March corn at 449.25, 3.75 higher, and the May at 456.25, up 3.25. July futures 462.25, 3 cents higher. December next year, $4.40.5, up 0.25 cents. September soybeans 10.22, up 9. November 10.26, 11.5 higher. January 10.34.25, up 12. The March at 10.38.75, 12.75 higher. Bean meal at 307.80, up 150. Bean oil at 40.20, up 71 for the day. Livestock August contract and live cattle down 37.5 at $98. And then nickel feeders at 116.27.5, 40 lower. And October lean hogs down 97.5 at 74.82.5. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, $75.12 a barrel, up $1.76. Ethanol at $1.92.6, 2 cents higher. Natural gas at $3.65.1, down 16.6. Heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.04.4, 3.5 cents higher for the day. And the gold futures at $1,236, a settlement price up 60 cents. The Dow at 10,129, just about 143 points higher for the day. The U.S. dollar at 82.92 is down 0.01, and the CRB index at 267.27 is 3.23 higher on the afternoon. The weather forecast looks like this for the area. Sunny skies today around Urbana-Champaign, a high near 82 degrees. South winds at about 5 miles an hour. Tonight should be clear, a low of about 55 degrees, light south-southeast winds. And then tomorrow for Saturday, sunny skies again, the high a little bit warmer today or tomorrow than it was today, 86 degrees, south-southeast winds between 3 and 9 miles an hour. Tomorrow night, clear, a low of 65 degrees. On Sunday, it'll be sunny again, high near 90, south winds between 5 and 13. It'll gust up to about 17 miles an hour. Sunday night, mostly clear, a low of around 65 degrees. The extended forecast says Monday will be sunny, Tuesday will be sunny, Wednesday will be sunny, and Thursday will be sunny. The highs between the mid-80s and the very, very low 90s, and the lows through that period in the mid-60s. Let's look at the forecast. We'll take a more complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour. And we talk with our very own state climatologist in Illinois. His name is Jim Angel.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon. On the phone line, as always with us on Friday, is Mike Zuzulo of Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. Good afternoon to you, Mike.
Hey there, Todd.
Hey, as we were discussing on the phone line just before we got started here, you made a phone call. This is one of the nice things about knowing Joe Prosaki. You made a phone call and asked him a question, and he had an answer for you about when they'd start the harvest numbers.
Well, you were talking about the advancement and the maturity this year on the radio one day this week while I was driving, and I thought to myself, why wouldn't we have harvest data that would be coming out earlier than normal since we're so far ahead on the maturity and the doe and the den? And he actually did get back to me and said that they may come out as early as September 7th, right after the holiday, and start publishing some harvest data on the corn and the beans, especially if they see the need to do that based upon this next Monday's maturity numbers. And so we may get it 2 to 3 weeks earlier than normal. I think that would be a great help to the trade and keep the trade from questioning too much about where we're headed in terms of yields. I think it'll be nice to get as much information as soon as possible.
You know what we're going to do with those numbers? If it comes out and harvest pressure is fast and it goes down, we're going to call that the Zuzulo zoom down.
I don't know if you want to do that, Todd. You might lose some listeners and some subscriberships, so be careful with using that last name like that.
Listen, it's a great Friday afternoon. Let's take a look at the numbers. We have numbers in the corn pit and across the grains. They're all in the green for the day. But on the week, beans were higher. Corn lost a quarter of a cent, so it kind of stayed steady.
You know, you don't know whether today's price action late in the day was September option expiration. And what I mean by that, Todd, is there's, I think, between 10 and 11,000 contracts of open interest still in September 420 corn calls going into the option expiration at lunchtime in Chicago. Did that pull the market down and make the market kind of gravitate back towards that level? Or was it that USDA came out this morning on their monthly rice report and put stocks as of August 1st? About 8.5% greater than what they said on their August 12th world supply and demand numbers. And we did note that the rice did drop pretty precipitously going into the final minutes of trade today. So you don't know whether it's that or the option expiration, but the net result of today's close for the week was not so great. It could have been a lot worse based upon where we were in the middle of the week, but I don't think with harvest coming, you know, the bulk of harvest, it sounds like, is really going to kick in next week in the central part of the Corn Belt if Mother Nature doesn't get in our way. And I think we're not out of the woods yet as far as seeing pressure. And I was surprised how many calls I would get, calls from producers that were telling me that they're hearing yields 30 to 40 bushels less than last year on corn on corn. But in the very next breath, they were telling me that basis had widened out 6 to 7 cents this week. I've got a map of Illinois-Indiana basis. I see a lot of mid-40s and even 50s for fall harvest basis right now in corn, and that is not very healthy for the futures market going into next week. And you add on top of that this lower weekly close, I'm not throwing in the towel, but it's not going to be an easy week for the bull next week in corn, in my view.
Where would that basis be normal at this time of year to be at 40 cents?
No, from what I can find in northern Indiana and, say, up by Pontiac and areas that in that area, you know, northern Illinois, northern Indiana, it's looking like it's about 8 to 12 cents wider than normal. I think they're essentially right now, before harvest starts, we're probably seeing basis widen as futures goes up. So one of the big things that should be fairly easy to spot is if the yields aren't there, I would think the future spreads would really see some bull spreading, and I think that basis would really start to pop and elevators would really start working harder to get grain if the yields aren't there during the heart of harvest.
Well, and you're thinking we'll only have to wait a week to figure that out?
Yeah, I really do. I think that we're at a point where we're so quick in harvesting now that if we get a full week of harvest data next week, and like I said, I would guess, if I had to put a number to it, I'd guess two-thirds of my clients from Kansas to Ohio will be hard at it in corn by next Friday, by a week from today, if the weather doesn't disrupt anything.
So we're running cash bids right at $4. for corn. What are you telling your clients about that, given what you're looking at? Are you saying, hang on, don't worry about it, or are you hedging your bets at this point?
Off the combine sales, I'm still recommending, but with a very wide basis like we're talking about, I would be more likely to recommend a hedge to arrive and leave your basis open until you actually start getting in the fields. You can always lock the basis in as you deliver the grain across the scales, and that's kind of the route I'm taking if you've got a really wide basis. I'm sticking with the idea that as we get up to this 440, 450 level, there's some more sales that need to be put on, but I'll probably continue to do that in the paper position until I know more about what's actually out there in the field. The early harvest reports, like I said, they started out really, really good this week. As the week went on, they tapered off, and I got more and more reports that corn on corn is indeed as disappointing as expected by producers. And it calls back into question the pro farmer number and the USDA number, and I think probably the trade picked up on that, especially on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday.
All right. So, but the trade itself, if basis is wide and you're here, and it's relatively self-selected what you hear from the producers, they'd like it to go higher, right?
Sure.
But on the other hand, the trade, the elevator, the end user would like it to go lower. So it's kind of a, until we get the crop in, there's a battle of wills at this point, and it appears that the elevators seem to think that the crop must be there, and they're more willing to believe what USDA said and what Pro Farmer has said.
I think you're 100% right on the battle of wills. I think the only difference we have this year that probably will, someone's hand will have to be forced, is this blending of the 09 corn. I think you're going to have to get, as an elevator, you're going to have to get 10 corn in as quickly as possible to meet the export needs. I heard last Friday a staggering number that the amount of shipping that was booked down at the Gulf was going all the way into the end of December, middle to end of December. So there is a lot of corn that needs to move south and be blended, and I think elevators are probably going to want to have to get some as the harvesters are rolling. And if you're looking at 45 to 50 cent under basis and you're looking at yields that are not there on the yield monitor when you get started next week, that just spells that, you know, producers, and you said this last week on Commodity Week, producers will likely just put it in the bin and lock the bin door as long as they can. I think that's the mindset they have anyway with the demand side of the market, and if they don't see their supplies out in the field and their moisture levels aren't what they want them to be, and goodness sakes, we hope the test weights are there, but if they're not there again, I think producers are going to be real likely to lock those bin doors and keep it away from the elevators. So I don't think we'll be able to play that same type of friction that we normally do this time of year.
You know, on this blend thing and how much corn is in rough shape and out there, let's see. Dave earlier in the week reported 25 to 35 million on barges. I thought that was kind of funny in New Orleans. Of course, they don't have any storage, so it's got to be put somewhere. So if they've actually, but that's a drop in the bucket. 1.3 is our carry out. And it's spread all over the Midwest. I don't know. I've thought about this for a while, and I guess at first I thought, well, they got to have a lot to blend. But 1.3 spread out over the Midwest doesn't mean they have to have a lot to blend. They just have to have a little in their area to blend. I don't know whether that's going to create as much of a logistical problem as I really first thought it might.
I think it will for about 2 weeks or maybe 3 weeks, if I had to guess. You know, I'm no cash grain operator. I admit that. I don't have a merchandise license. But based upon what clients and what other people that run elevators that I work with have said, you're probably looking at a 1 to 3 week slot here, gut slot here, of if the yields are there, then you will have that gut slot. But if the yields are not there, then that there's obviously less coming in the elevator across the scales, and I think it'll make the producer want to go ahead and store more. So I think that's where we're not going to be able to, I think, see that same type of friction last very long if the yields aren't there. And I think in that sense, you're going to have to see the basis levels improve.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Hey, Todd, have a great week, sir.
Hey, you too. Mike Zuzulo is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. Joined us here on Friday afternoon. You can hear him again at willag.org. Dave Dickey is here now. He'll take us through the agricultural news for the afternoon.
In agricultural news, a House panel wants the owners of two Iowa companies involved in a massive egg recall to explain how eggs from their farms were linked to as many as 1,300 cases of salmonella poisoning. A House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee will hold a hearing on the recall on September 14th. The committee is inviting Austin Jack DeCoster, the owner of Wright County Egg, and Orland Betho, the owner of Hillendale Farms, to testify. The panel has also asked for records of inspections and past communications with the two farms, along with other documents. DeCoster has not responded to media interview requests. Meanwhile, U.S. regulators today say that chicken feed contaminated with salmonella bacteria could have caused the outbreak. While the feed was a likely source of contamination, it may not be the only one, and more samples will be analyzed. Samples that tested positive for salmonella were collected from barns at the two farms and from feed ingredients at both farms. The Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago says that farmland values in America's northern Corn Belt states rose 6% for the second quarter of 2010. A report from the Fed says rising demand for U.S. grain should provide support for both corn and soybean prices, which in turn will enhance district farmland values. The Fed's 7th district stretches across Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Michigan. Value of good farmland in the district compared to the first quarter of 2010, however, was unchanged. Wisconsin was the only state in the district to see a drop in farmland compared to a year ago, down 1%, reflecting the struggling dairy industry. Interest rates on agricultural loans edged lower. Farm mortgage rates averaged 5.99%, almost 190 basis points lower than 4 years ago, and just the second dip below 6% in the history of the survey. The International Grains Council yesterday cut its forecast for Russia's wheat crop by 12%, saying it only expects the drought-ravaged country to produce 44 million metric tons this year. Russia's total grain harvest is expected to fall 15% to 65.5 million tons, down 11.7 million tons from IGC's July estimate. Meanwhile, the CEO of SovEcon today says that Russia may need to import up to 6 million tons of grain in the current 2010-11 crop year. SovEcon expects wheat imports to be 1.5 million tons and barley imports at 1.8 million. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Mark Report and of Commodity Week. Our panelists, by the way, really good for Commodity Week. Paul Cooley, Matt Bennett, and Greg Johnson. And the guest this week will be Sue Martin. We'll post it to the website at willag.org by about 6 o'clock this evening. If you just can't wait to hear it on the radio station, visit willag.org and look for Commodity Week. Now, up next, I told you earlier in the program that RMA from the United States Department of Agriculture has updated its crop insurance product list. They've changed a few names, things have gone missing, and a few things have been combined. You'll hear more in a moment. USDA's Risk Management Agency, or RMA, is responsible for the federal crop insurance products. When the farmers, wheat this fall and other crops next spring, when the farmers sign up to have the 2011 crops federally insured, they'll find some new names and a few missing items. Well, Gary Schnitke follows the crop insurance for University of Illinois and has posted an article outlining the new crop insurance combo products on the FarmDoc website.
What we tried to do in this article is just explain the basics of it and also linked what the combo product plans are to the old plans that producers used to buy. So if a producer used to buy CRC and RA with the harvest price option under the combo product, that will be now revenue protection. And actually, revenue protection works very much the same as CRC and RA. So the combo product also has a yield protection plan, which is the same as APH, and a revenue protection with a harvest price exclusion, which would be the same as RA with a base price option and income protection.
The idea behind the new combos, the updated federal crop insurance package, is to streamline the process. To that end, Extension Farm Management Specialist Schnitke says farmers should make note some of the old products are simply gone.
Before this, if you wanted a revenue plan with a harvest guarantee increase, you could look at either CRC or RA harvest price. Now there's only one, so eliminated the choices. The idea was to make it simpler and more coherent across the plans.
Well, farmers wanting to ensure the 2011 winter wheat crop will be the first to sign up for the new products. That'll happen yet this fall. It is why Schnitke used wheat as an example in the FarmDoc website article on the new insurance combos.
We took wheat as an example because if you're signing up for wheat, that deadline is approaching in September. So we give examples of how revenue protection, yield protection, and revenue protection with the harvest price exclusion works. We also have a little table in there that maps the products, so you can look at revenue protection and what it replaces.
You may read Schnitke's article on the updated crop insurance choices on the FarmDoc website at www.farmdoc.illinois.edu. He says most farmers want to know if and how premiums for the products might change. Those calculations are not yet available, but as soon as they are, they'll be incorporated into the crop insurance calculators also available on the FarmDoc website. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support comes from Stewart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stewart-peterson.com.
You know, a bit earlier in the program, I told you I'd been thinking about all that out-of-shape corn and what was happening with it and what was happening down at the Gulf. And frankly, I shouldn't have said that. I had a conversation with Daryl Good. That's where I was thinking about it. And Daryl and I talked that out for a bit. By the way, that 158.1 on the corn yield is a model. So that gets updated every week, and it's updated with the crop progress report because that's part of the model. Earlier in the week, I think it was at 158.5. We'll try to keep you updated on what that number from the U of I looks like each and every week as those crop progress numbers come out. On the phone line with us this afternoon to talk about progress in his area and basis and those things is Bruce Bostard with Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company. Hi, Bruce. How are you today?
Hi there.
Well, anybody harvesting?
We have not had any new crop come in yet, but we've had an awful lot of coffee cans walk in the door for the last week.
And how wet?
Oh, anywhere from 17-18% up to 30, although there are a lot more clustering in that 23 to 25 range. Test weights all over the place, although they seem to be coming up a little bit as the moisture comes down, which is what you would hope for and expect, and in the 55-56 pound range.
Yeah, so they're satisfied they're going to leave it in the field and let her dry, I suppose, this year, aren't they?
unless we get a call, I'm waiting for a call about 10 minutes before we close for the first load to come in, but other than that, I think we'll see it next week.
All right, and then what's basis look like in your area?
Corn is pretty much steady. We switched to the Dease and gained a cent on the nearby. New crop is steady. Old crop means losing a little bit of ground as we come on here, down 5 cents, and new crop up a penny.
How wide is the basis? How far under are you?
We are 5 over the nove nearby on beans, 27 under for straight new crop, and running 37 under the Dease on the corn.
And would that be wide for this time of year for you, do you know?
Oh, that would be on the wider side of normal, I would say. It's not an abnormal new crop basis, but it's not something I'd want to go in and make a basis sale on right now if I had other options.
We're out of time. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's the Feast of St. Monica, patron of homemakers and housewives. On this day in agricultural history in 1859, Colonel Edwin L. Drake drilled the first successful oil well in the U.S. near Titusville, Pennsylvania. The drilling hit oil at 69 feet 6 inches. When under the derrick floor was seen a dark film floating on the water. In 1874, Carl Bosch was born, a German industrial chemist. He directed the development of the industrial-scale processes for production of ammonia from atmospheric nitrogen. He eventually won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for devising chemical high-pressure methods, like that which produced ammonia out of nitrogen and hydrogen gases. In 1879, Sir Rowland Hill died, an English educator. He was the inventor of the penny postage system, with the first adhesive postage stamp in 1840. In 1928, the Kellogg-Briand Pact was signed in Paris. It outlawed war and provided for the peaceful settlement of disputes. And in 1998, former U.S. Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy was charged with accepting more than $35,000 in gifts from companies that did business with USDA. He was eventually found innocent, but seven others were found guilty of similar charges. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Bob Baisdiffer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon. State climatologist Jim Angel now joins us from the Water Survey here on campus to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Hi, Jim. How are you today?
Good afternoon, Todd.
It's been a beautiful, beautiful week, and I suppose it looks like it's going to be at least really nice through the weekend, maybe longer than that. What's the forecast tell us?
Yeah, if you look at the forecast for this weekend, it's pretty nice. They will be pretty warm. I think the high on Saturday will be 86 degrees and get up to 91 on Sunday and Monday. But nighttime lows will be down in the 60s. And probably the best news is the humidity will be a lot less. So it'll be very comfortable out there, even though the temperatures will be quite warm.
When's our next chance for rainfall?
You know, looking at the models from the National Weather Service, it may be next Wednesday or Thursday before we see the next round of rainfall. Until then, skies are going to be clear and lots of sunshine.
Tell me about the month of August. We've just about wrapped it up. It seemed pretty warm.
That's right, it was. We ended up being 3.3 degrees above normal. And that makes it the 12th warmest August on record for the state. And also statewide rainfall was 3.4 inches, which is pretty close to normal. But here in Champaign, it's actually been pretty dry. A lot of east central Illinois has missed out on the rains this month. And, for example, in Champaign, we had 1.6 inches compared to our normal of 4.4 inches. So the grass is looking pretty brown out there.
How do they calculate those on a statewide basis? I mean, how do they get an average?
Yeah, what we do is we take all the reports around the state and average those together to get a statewide number. Now we get about 100 to 200 reports around the state, so it's pretty extensive.
You told me that east central Illinois was fairly dry. We live here, we know that. Any other parts of the state that were fairly dry, and who was really wet?
Yeah, the western Illinois, as usual, has been on the wet side this month. They've had a long string of very wet weather going all the way back to the April-May time frame. So very wet over there, not quite as extraordinary as other months, but a lot of places are seeing totals of in excess of 5 or 6 inches there. Southern Illinois has been another dry spot. They've been dry all summer. They got a few rains in the last week or so, but that area of the state remains dry, and basically south of I-64.
Jim, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
State climatologist from the Illinois State Water Survey, Jim Angel. You're listening to the Closing Market Report. Stay with us if you can. For the Farming World, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This agricultural programming is a production of Illinois Public Media from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. This is the Farming World News and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today we're joined by Professor Stephen Long. He's in crop sciences here at the U of I and researching CO2, climate change, and the impact it may or may not have on crops in the future. Professor Long, thank you for being with us. I know that you operate the Soyface experiment here on this campus and that you're looking at how carbon dioxide concentrations, particularly in the future, might change what happens in the field. The expectation, I suppose, early on, within the last 20 years, is that as CO2 rises, that the crops would do better because, of course, they use carbon dioxide. Is that right?
Yes, the expectation. We have expectations both from laboratory studies and from theory that rising carbon dioxide levels should stimulate the yields of crops.
And is that still the view a couple of decades after this idea was first put forward?
Well, now that we have experiments where we can actually elevate the carbon dioxide level in a very controlled way in a farmer's field, we're not seeing those stimulations in the field. And that is of concern because that stimulation is one of the factors which is expected to offset the more damaging aspects of climate change in considering global food production.
Just for clarification purpose then, as forests around the globe are cut down, I'm thinking of the Amazon jungle particularly, if that should happen and has happened in the past, those forests no longer are using up carbon dioxide, and that makes higher CO2 levels available across the planet. And the idea then potentially was that that available CO2, while dangerous in some respects, would give crops, other plants, a leg up on production.
Yes, there are two reasons for that. One is crops we call C3 crops, which include wheat, rice, and soybean, have this process called photorespiration, which basically burns away some of the carbon that has recently been fixed by the plant, on average about 30%. Now, rising CO2 inhibits this photorespiration, and that's the theory. And if we do this in a controlled environment in the laboratory, we see that response. So the expectation for a long time was, well, this rising CO2 would increase the yield of those crops. There is a second factor as well, that as there's more CO2 available, the plant has to lose less water to obtain that carbon dioxide. And again, in the laboratory, that appears to benefit all plants. But as so often is the case, once we take the theory to the farmer's field, we don't always see the same response. And of course, that now raises more research questions.
Is that to say then that the fundamental theory that higher levels of CO2 will help us to feed ourselves in the future is not true?
I wouldn't say it's not true at all, but we're only seeing, in these large field-scale experiments, we're only seeing, with soybean and wheat and rice, we're only seeing about half of the response that was expected, and half the response that has been used in predictions of future food supply.
It's a very complicated field, it seems, and one that still has a lot of work to be done. There are ideas that respiration either goes up or goes down, depending on what's happening with the CO2?
Yes. And again, I think it's perhaps been, now that we have better techniques for looking at respiration, the evidence really is for increased respiration, certainly not decreased.
Can you draw any conclusions or silver linings from the rising CO2 levels?
Well, I'd say it's certainly not the silver lining we were expecting. On the other hand, if if we can show that plants can do this in the laboratory, then we really need to understand, well, why isn't this happening in the field? Are there factors we could be selecting for genetically that would overcome this so that we would get the theoretical gain? What we have found here with our work on soybean is that there is variability between cultivars. So it appears there must be some genes which do favour this response. So you're right, the silver lining's not at least as easily obtained as we thought, but this isn't without hope.
I hope you don't mind if I ask you a bit of a personal question. There's lots of debate around the globe about climate change on both sides, especially within the science community. I wonder if you feel like an embattled figure to some extent, or that if science doesn't quite get understood on the journalist side or from the public side, that it's not really as black and white as we'd all like it to be, and that there are variabilities that, well, science either hasn't discovered or can't take into account just yet.
Well, this is an extremely complex issue. You know, as we know, just with the climate science area, you know, we're obviously looking at a very, you know, one of the most complex systems there is, the climate and atmosphere interacting with the vegetation. There are a lot of unknowns in all of that. I mean, I have no doubt that the basics are correct, though, that the climate is changing. And, of course, we know very precisely that the CO2 level of the world is rising day by day. We know, too, from our analyses that our crops are already not adapted to today's conditions. They're adapted to conditions of the past in terms of the atmosphere. So there are very clear issues there. And I'd say, you know, we're right in the middle of the Corn Belt here, where a lot of people depend on their crops for their livelihood and people working around them. And certainly in that community, there is concern about what is happening and, you know, what can be done about it. So, you know, the perspectives may differ from different locations.
Does it frustrate you that people want definitive answers so quickly, so early in this process? And while you suggest that we know definitively some of the answers, that certainly we may not know all of them at this point?
Well, I mean, that may be part of the problem, that, you know, people have wanted very clear answers, which, particularly without the investment in the science, is very difficult to deliver. I mean, it's taken really, 2001 was where our large field-scale experiment started. So this was the first one to look at corn and soybean anywhere in the world, you know, at a farm scale. And it really seems, we know from, for example, industry trials of herbicides and other chemicals, that these have to be done at a farm scale. You can get brilliant results in the lab. The company takes it to the field and it doesn't work. So we shouldn't perhaps be too surprised that, you know, what we devise in the lab and in theory doesn't always work in the field. And indeed, science typically is about, well, you test it in the real world and then if the answer is slightly different, you need to come back to the lab and look at what is missing in that information.
So if I can ask for something a bit definitive, how is it that you account for the lab experiments that suggest that CO2, extra CO2, is good for plants, but in the field it may not show up?
The field situation is very different. If you take, you know, a controlled environment or a controlled greenhouse, temperatures do not change very much. The moisture and humidity are controlled. When you're in the field, for example, and, you know, we have here in central Illinois, we have some of the best growing conditions in the world. Temperature will vary 15 degrees Celsius over the course of a day, maybe more. The humidity may go from sort of 100% relative humidity to 50%. And of course, light is changing all the time, fluctuating. Plants behave somewhat differently in a fluctuating environment, and we do know a lot less about that. But so there are a number of other factors which may change it. Of course, the rooting environment is very different when you're in a farmer's field to in pots in the laboratory or controlled environments.
So that fluctuating environment that your soy face experiment is in the midst of in a field here in central Illinois, is one of the ways or one of the reasons that explains the difference between laboratory results and field results.
Yes, I think that may be one of the factors. But, you know, as I said earlier, I think what we now need to do is we do know that cultivars differ in their response. So that means there are some aspects of the genetics which favor a response. There may be some genes which favor the response. So really what we need to be able to do now is at the field level, identify those genes, identify markers close to them so that breeders can then select for this responsiveness to CO2.
So that is to say, soybean breeders, corn breeders, plant breeders of all types should look for plants that might respond more favorably to CO2, and that's one of the things that you've seen as a result of the soy face experiments?
Well, I think we've, from, and unfortunately around the world, there have been a very limited number of these field experiments done. So we're working with very limited information. But what we have seen is that one line of the species will respond more than another one. So that does give us a handle. If we can then say, okay, what are the genes that are allowing this plant to do better than this one? Then we've got something that breeders can start to use. And we've seen that's true with wheat, with rice, with soybean, even with corn. So there are, globally, they're the four biggest crops in terms of food production.
Professor Long, thank you so much for taking the time with us today. That's Stephen Long. He's a professor at the University of Illinois in crop sciences and is a primary in the soy face experiment. Soy face, by the way, stands for soybean free air concentration enrichment. It's an innovative facility for growing crops under production field conditions in an atmosphere that has higher levels of carbon dioxide and ozone, higher temperature, and sometimes altered soil water availability. Soyface was designed to discover the effects of atmospheric change on the agronomy and production of Midwestern crops, as well as to find solutions that will lead to crops better adapted to this future. It's a unique facility and highly interdisciplinary, according to the Soyface webpage, which is at soyface.illinois.edu. And the research teams there work to answer several questions. These include, what yield and quality changes will result with rising CO2, temperature, drought stress, and ozone? What genotypes or genes may be exploited to increase yield and maintain quality under those changed atmospheric conditions? What system changes will increase yields and maintain quality under that atmosphere? Will soil quality degrade, and how can that be alleviated? Will rates of soil carbon deposition be increased, and what value might that have in terms of carbon credits? And finally, how will changes in CO2, temperature, and drought stress and ozone impact insect and pathogens? It's all at the Soyface Experiment here in Urbana-Champaign. You can visit the Soyface website again at soyface.illinois.edu. You're listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. In business news, the Commerce Department today says that U.S. economic growth slowed more sharply than initially thought in the second quarter, held back by the largest increase in imports in 26 years. Gross domestic product expanded at a 1.6% annual rate instead of the 2.4% pace estimated last month. growth in the last quarter was stifled by a 32.4% surge in imports, the largest since the first quarter of 1984, dwarfing a 9.1% rise in exports. That created a trade deficit, which sliced off 3.37 percentage points from GDP, the largest subtraction since the fourth quarter of 1947. Britain's economy grew at its fastest pace for 9 years in the second quarter. Strong construction activity caused the Office for National Statistics to boost its initial estimate of 1.1% GDP growth for the 3 months to June to 1.2%. Monsanto Company has acquired a 19.9% minority interest in Intergrain Pty Ltd., an Australian cereal breeder, in its effort to bring biotech wheat to world markets. The stake is part of a collaboration agreement aimed at developing wheat varieties with improved yield performances, enhanced disease resistance, and drought tolerance, as well as improved and use qualities. And that's a look at today's business news. Hi, this is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Coming up next, okay, so you've got a bumper crop of backyard garden delights. You have peppers and potatoes and tomatoes, oh my. What do you do with all of that delectable fresh produce? Lisa Brautz has some answers in her latest edition of In My Backyard.
I had the best dill pickle I've ever had last weekend. Meet my friend Asher. He's 3 years old, and he's a cucumber farmer.
Tomato soup, tomatoes, and I harvested them, and they were next to my cucumber tunnel.
Right there at the end, Asher mentions a cucumber tunnel. It's where he tended his crop of pickling cucumbers in his family's garden. After harvest, he helped his parents, Kate and Ben, pickle the cukes he'd harvested, a 5-gallon bucket's worth. And they were incredible. What was great after I took my first bite of the pickle and went on about how tasty it was how Asher didn't even look especially proud. He just looked like he understood that, yeah, of course that pickle is awesome. It came from my garden. Duh. It's hardcore food preservation season right now. Late summer is when the food really starts to roll in, when there are more tomatoes and peppers and fruit than you can possibly eat or give away if you have a big varied garden. And there's plenty to buy directly from farmers if you don't have a garden. This season's weather has been, overall, pretty conducive to the growing of food. What to do with it all? How about preserving it? Putting it up for the winter, little house in the big woods style. Remember the braided onions and dried peppers and huge pumpkins stored in the Ingalls attic? That little smokehouse they had? Those big yellow cheeses wrapped just so in paper by Ma? There are a lot of ways to preserve food. Pickling, canning, drying, freezing, and smoking are some of the most common. Food preservation is a fading art, enjoying a bit of a renaissance in these times thanks to renewed interest, not just in having local food around to eat when the snow flies, but also interest in learning such a skill that becomes necessary, not just handy, when you're fairly new to gardening and are unsure of what to do with your unexpectedly bumper crop of tomatoes. While you might need some equipment to start, especially if you're going the canning route on your own, food preservation is generally pretty inexpensive and assures that fresh garden produce, or even some that might be a little bit overripe, won't go to waste. In fact, it seems like the three biggest obstacles to learning food preservation, other than time, but that's another subject for another day, are knowing what kind of equipment to use, having access to it, and knowing how to use it. And that's where the Neighborhood Food Preservation Party comes in. Ben Lubchansky and Kate Zombratz Lubchansky live in my neighborhood. They decided that one way to help corral all that garden and market produce and to encourage people to try their hand at canning or drying or roasting was to open up their kitchen and backyard. So last weekend, they hosted a neighborhood food preservation 101 of sorts. All skill sets were welcome to join in and use Kate and Ben's kitchen and appliances, many of which are commercial grade and enormous, as well as their books and their brains.
I am slicing peaches to freeze. The peaches came from a tree in our front yard that I planted 7 years ago when I bought my house. And we're going to freeze them, and then probably throughout the winter and into the spring, we'll take them out and make smoothies with them, pies, cobblers, things like that.
Clint's wife, Beth, was nearby flipping fresh peppers over a huge grill.
I'm roasting these jalapenos and poblano peppers. Got them from Blue Moon Farm. I'm going to put them in the freezer and pull them out all winter long so I can enjoy fresh, smoky flavor.
And then there was Micah, who was making something special in the kitchen.
I am currently brewing a batch of English bitters-style beer at Kate and Ben Lipchansky's house. And what I'm essentially doing now is boiling the wort. And after I do that, I will be putting it into two carboys and fermenting it. But the really neat thing about this batch of beer today is that most of my hops that I'm using came from La Casa, just down the street. They have a few hop vines. And so I have some Cascade hops that I'll be putting into this batch here for my aroma hops.
What I found most compelling about this whole idea was the conviviality of it. People getting together to share equipment, skills, and recipes in much the same way some of our grandparents or great-grandparents did. I've done my share of food preserving and know it can be a hot, messy business, but it's made way more fun with the addition of others doing the same thing. It's what Kate and Ben were after, too.
Since we have at our disposal a lot of commercial-style equipment, including a range and giant pots, dehydrators, blenders, big double grill, and now some space for people to work, we thought one of the ways to beat sort of the sweltering, sort of oppressive labor of canning, putting up a beer, is to be outside and to use this large-scale equipment to facilitate things, to help people do things in larger batches, and to spend time together, sort of the a la summer kitchen idea.
We are really big into making sure that we're eating local all year round, so we try to do as much of that as possible, and putting things up in the most efficient manner possible kind of makes things a lot easier.
Kate and Ben plan to have more food preservation days at their home this fall to accommodate the growing season. Think of it like this. Food preservation is a logical extension of the garden that started this spring. When we reap what we or others sow, we have to do something with it if we can't eat it all. And like anything else, it's way more fun when you have friends working alongside you. So grab some freezer bags and some local peaches or some jars and some of those tomatoes and a few friends. In December, you'll be glad you did.
Lisa Brott's stories can also be heard on our website, WILLAG.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can also read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com. If you have an idea for a future edition of In My Backyard, drop us an email at willagstaff@illinois.edu. That's willagstaff@illinois.edu. Or call us at area code 217-333-7300.